It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we hear your plans for 2016. You can call us and tell us what you're looking forward to at 800-642-1234. You can share the trips you're planning and the books you'd like to read and other goals for that coming year.
First, there's a lot of history that's common knowledge for people. The big years like 1492 and 1776 here in the United States. 1066 and all that for the English. And there are events that are part of our consciousness. Victory over the Nazis in World War II, the moon landing, the fall of the Berlin Wall.
And then there are the lesser known stories, the forgotten chapters, the strange stuff that doesn't quite make it into the history books, except for the ones written by our next guest.
Giles Milton joins us now for a look at some of the more unusual stories from the pages of history. He's a writer and a journalist. His newest book is called When Hitler Took Cocaine and Lenin Lost His Brain, History's Unknown Chapters. Giles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So before we get to some of the particular historical events you share in your books, what kind of stories are you out hunting for when you're, camped out in an archive all day?
Well, that's exactly what I do. I spend a lot of my time in the archives going through all these, box loads of papers. And I just, every now and then, you stumble across an incredible story and you think, I can't believe that's true. And I start to investigate. And generally, they are true, and they're amazing, and most people don't know about them. So I decided to put them all together and put them into a book.
Well, since I said the title of your book, I imagine people are curious about the story's reference there. So let's talk about Hitler and cocaine and his doctor, and not just cocaine, lots and lots of drugs. Tell the story behind that.
Yeah, this is a really extraordinary story, and it only came to light a couple of years ago when Hitler had a physician, a personal doctor called Theodor Morell, who kept an awful lot of papers about the Führer's health. And these papers were uncovered in the American archives just a few years ago. And they revealed that the Hitler was taking the most extraordinary cocktail of drugs, from amphetamines, testosterone, sedatives, laxatives, all of these things to try and control his very poor health. And to sort of hype him up, to pump him up for, your listeners will be familiar with seeing those stories of Hitler giving extravagant speeches and everything. And these were all done while he was fueled with amphetamines and other drugs. And perhaps the most surprising of all that came to light in the doctor's papers was Hitler's frequent use of cocaine, which certainly came as a surprise to me. He began taking it as eye drops, which was it was apparently used in the 1920s and 30s in Germany, but he soon became addicted to it and started snorting it to, as he put it, clear his sinuses.
And there are reports, I understand, of psychotic episodes, two-hour rants to, I think, Mussolini and other world leaders and his staff, things like that, just really crazy drugged-out behavior.
Yeah, basically, he was pumped up, pumped full of so many drugs that's why he had these crazy moods. And you're right, these monologues that would go on for hours, At one point, he was recorded by his doctor as taking up to 80 drugs a day. And Hitler was not a particularly virile man. And, of course, when he went to spend an evening with his girlfriend, or his mistress, he had to take large injections of testosterone to help him perform.
And tell us more about this doctor. I mean, a lot of people, in Hitler's inner circle, distrusted this guy.
Yeah, because Hitler had several personal physicians. Most of them were bona fide doctors. But Dr. Theodor Morell was really what we call a quack doctor. He was not very well trained. He didn't really know what he was doing. But Hitler suffered from appalling stomach cramps and problems with his digestion, partly because he ate this sort of mushed up soup of pureed vegetables for every meal. And Dr. Theodor Morell claimed he could cure this with his wonder drugs. And he gave some to Hitler, and they worked. And really, from that moment on, Hitler trusted implicitly Dr. Theodor Morell and put his entire health troubles into this quack doctor's hands.
Well, I want to move east a little bit now to another world leader and a story after his death, actually. Vladimir Lenin, leader of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, a hero to the Bolsheviks there. His body still preserved to this day, something I did not know, though. His body is there, his brain is not.
Yeah, in fact, I was in Moscow not so long ago and actually saw his body. Slightly weird experience to see this wax-like corpse lying in a glass box. But yes, you're right, his brain is not there. because it was believed that Lenin, the great genius of the Bolshevik, the Soviet revolution, must have some incredible thing inside his brain. So his brain was removed from his body when he died and sliced into thousands, about tens of thousands of microscopically thin, wafer-thin slices. And neurosurgeons began to study these slices to find out if they could find the source of Lenin's great communist genius.
Well, now, neuroscience has advanced a lot in the last century or so. I imagine that even if there had been something like there, they probably wouldn't have found it.
Well, you know, what happened is that the Soviets hired all the great neurosurgeons of the day, and you're right, neuroscience was in its very infancy in those days, and they studied these slices of brain, and they looked into them, and they discovered that there was an extraordinary thing about Lenin's brain, one that had to be kept completely secret, and that was this fact. There was absolutely nothing special about it at all.
You wouldn't want word of that to get out, I guess.
Yeah, you wouldn't. They had to keep that rather quiet.
So what then happened to his brain? Do we still know where Lenin's brain is today?
Oh, yeah, the Lenin's brain is still kept in its tens of thousands of slices in Moscow. A vast sort of encyclopedia-length volume was written about this extraordinary brain that wasn't actually so extraordinary after all. But for the moment, the brain still lies there in Moscow, as does the body, and I think no one quite knows what to do with it.
Talking to Giles Milton, his new book is When Hitler Took Cocaine and Lenin Lost His Brain, History's Unknown Chapters. He tells some of the out-of-the-way odd stories from world history. Now, here's one, another big name here, Agatha Christie, mystery writer. She created all sorts of interesting, compelling mysteries. She created one in real life when she disappeared. Tell us that story.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about this, even though I've read lots of her books. In 1926, when she was already famous, she was a household name, certainly in Britain and probably in America as well, she suddenly disappeared without trace. One evening, she left home, she got in her car and drove away, and was not seen again for 10 days. Now, the police began to investigate. They soon found her abandoned car, but no sign of Agatha Christie herself. What had happened? It led to the largest police woman hunt in history of my country. The police called in Arthur Conan Doyle, the famous crime writer. They called in Dorothy Sayers, another famous crime writer, to try and work out what might have happened. But no one could find her. And for 10 days, there was this incredible hunt across the country. And eventually, she was tracked down to a hotel in Harrogate, where, bizarrely, she checked into the hotel using the name of her husband's mistress.
And as I understand it, well, I'll say I was searching after I read this part of your book, and I saw an article from last year, Agatha Christie disappearance mystery solved. But then I looked at the article, and it was like, a doctor has a theory about some sort of brief mental breakdown. We still don't know exactly why Agatha Christie disappeared for 10 days, do we?
We still don't know, no. But it does seem quite likely that she had some sort of nervous collapse. I mean, it's very strange that she should use the name of her husband's mistress as her assumed identity. Her husband was this sort of philandering womanizer, treated her appallingly. And very soon afterwards, she ditched him and married a far nicer person. So the most likely explanation is that it was a mental collapse. But we just don't know. It's most extraordinary. To be able to hide from the police for 10 days like that was also extraordinary.
We focused on big names so far, but a lot of your stories were about people we've probably never heard the names of. One, though, has made it onto the big screen a couple times. A man who survived the Titanic disaster, in part, apparently, by being drunk. He was a character, I don't know how prominent, in the big Titanic movie and A Night to Remember. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, this is a really odd story, actually. This is a story of Charles Joachim, who was one of the ship's bakers on the Titanic. He was also one of the first people to realize that the ship was doomed when it struck an iceberg. And he realized that there were not enough lifeboats for everyone on board. And as a lowly ship's baker, he was going to be sacrificed to allow, you know, the passengers into the lifeboats first. So he decided, well, what am I going to do? He had two bottles of whiskey. He downed both bottles of whiskey and then slipped into the sea as the ship was going under. Now, normally drinking of that much hard spirits ought to kill you very, very quickly, especially if you're on freezing water. The water was below freezing at that time. But bizarrely and miraculously, he survived hours in the sea and was eventually pulled out and hauled aboard one of the lifeboats and lived to tell the tale. And no one has really ever been able to explain how he managed to survive so many hours in water that, as I say, was below freezing.
Yeah, not one for people to try at home, the get really drunk and then go in freezing water.
I wouldn't recommend it necessarily, no.
So we've just sampled a handful of your stories, and you told us kind of how you look for them. The big question I want to end with, though, is why? Why should we look for these nooks and crannies and things that don't even quite make the footnotes of the standard histories?
Well, I think they are very interesting because they shed new light on characters, perhaps familiar characters. I mean, we all know about Hitler, but did we realize that he was on this drug crazed sort of rant for most of his political career? I also like the stories that tell of people who are perhaps not known at all, but what they've been through, the things they've experienced, shed light on a whole new episode of history. So although they're little vignettes, if you like, and they are footnotes, the idea is that they actually open a window onto a much larger historical episode.
Well, leave us with one of the lesser-known people that really struck you, one of your most interesting, compelling stories.
Well, the one I like, actually, is... I've always been a great fan of the dodo bird, which I'm sure your listeners will know became extinct a long time ago. But I wondered, how did it become extinct? And I discovered that in the 1660s, a Dutch ship got washed up. It was shipwrecked in Mauritius, and the men lost all their food, had absolutely nothing to eat. They were starving, and they saw this peculiar bird waddling around. In fact, they found dozens of them, and they found them very easy to kill. They killed the lot. They ate the lot, and we now know that over those few days were the last few remaining dodos on the planet. And from that point on, the dodo became extinct.
All right. Well, Giles, thanks a lot for joining us today and sharing some of these stories.
Thank you very much for having me on. Thanks.
That's Giles Milton, writer and journalist. His newest book is called When Hitler Took Cocaine and Lenin Lost His Brain.
That's a very sad story on National
Sad story
Bird Day.
To end up on National Bird Day, no less. But now we know.
Well, it's an interesting story for sure.
We're going to take your calls on your plans for 2016, not resolutions. I mean, you can call in with resolutions if you want. We just want to know what you have on your agenda for 2016 at 800-642-1234. New year, time to maybe make some plans. We want to know, what have you got going on? What are the books that you want to read in 2016, the places you want to visit, what new hobbies or things are you going to try this year? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post your plans on the Central Time Facebook page or email us, talk@wpr.org.
Yeah, we want to know, what do you want to accomplish this year? Do you have maybe friends that you want to reconnect with that you've lost touch with? And what kind of vacation do you have planned or would you like to begin planning? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And I'll get us started. And we've got some thoughts from our colleagues here, too. And I'm glad we're not thinking resolutions, because that's too much pressure. But I think after talking to Stephen Thompson, our NPR music friend last year, you know, he had the best songs of 2015, mm-hmm. best albums. And I kept coming up with the ones that I was going to throw in and looking. And I was like, oh, no, that was 2014. Oh, no, that was 2010. So I'm gonna try to like check out more brand new release type music, possibly guided by Stephen in this year, 2016. And you know, there's always good music coming out, and I always discover it a decade later.
Right, you know, we did that interview about how we stop listening to new music past a certain age, both of which you and I are past, I think. So I think
27, was it?
27, right. 27. Both of us are over 27. So, yeah, please share some of the new finds if you bring it in.
I will do that. And do you have any new plans before we go to callers and our colleagues, Sue?
Looking for a new co-host. Oops. Oh. No, I wouldn't trade you. Thinking of a road trip this summer at some point, maybe out west.
Yeah, we've been talking about trying to do something like that too, Glacier or something like that, or Grand Canyon if we're feeling
I've never
really
seen the Grand Canyon.
Ambitious, me neither.
I've never seen the American Southwest except for a very quick stopover on Amtrak once in New Mexico and Arizona. But I'd love to get off the train and see what's there.
To the car. Let's stop hosting a show like suckers and hit the road.
In winter? Oh, it's actually
no, wait. Our boss is right there. We can't do that. Well, hey. Let's get to our callers now. We've got Tom on the line in Green Bay. Tom, hi. What do you got for us?
Hi. My wife and I will be heading to Tahiti on the 1st of February for a cruise, going from there to Sydney, Australia.
Wow. Is this like a dream trip of a lifetime kind of situation, Tom?
We were in the South Pacific a couple of years ago, and then this cruise came up, so we decided to take it. So we're taking the month off in February.
That sounds fantastic, Tom, and something that I would aspire to one day, to be able to leave Wisconsin for a month in February. This winter is snuck up on us all, but it is a fun time to sort of go to ground, think about the things that make you happy that you would like to do in 2016. Another thing I would maybe like to get back to is dancing. I don't really dance, so don't give me that look of surprise, but I did take, tango classes for one session. It was really fun.
Cool.
You don't have to be that good.
Well, now, how about you? What is on your agenda, your plan, your list, your to-do list for 2016? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our colleague Lisa Wilbur, a graphic design here at WPR, wants to read The Obstacle in the Way by Ryan Holiday. That's a recommendation from her brother. And she's going to travel not to Australia, to southern Indiana to celebrate her grandmother's 100th birthday. Plus, and this is a more typical New Year's resolution, wants a good fitness routine.
And so, our corporate development consultant, Tim Brown, said his plans for 2016 include a fly-in wilderness fishing trip in Canada, losing 30 pounds, and also turning 50. That one's definitely achievable. Well, Tim, congrats on those.
Yep. And now how about you? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. What do you want to do in 2016? Whether it's travel, a book you want to read, hobby you want to take up or rekindle, something you want to get back into, or volunteering, getting out there and doing something. 800-642-1234. Another one of mine is, and I've got to start donating blood again. I stopped, I had some surgery. Over a year ago, I think I've pulled through.
I think
I'm ready to get back in the chair and donate platelets to the Red Cross.
Well, call in with yours at 800-642-1234. Something you feel will be positive in your life, something you're looking forward to, maybe something like donating blood. 800-642-1234. We've got our technical director, Michelle Good, in studio as always at the helm of the ship here. Michelle, what are you looking forward to in 2016?
Well, last year I went to France on one of those WPR trips.
Yep.
And when I got back, my car died. And it was like $2,000, $3,000. All kinds of things went wrong. Muffler, front, coil springs, etc. Turns out it was a recall. So I'm going to get money back. And going on that France trip really got the travel bug going. So I don't know where, but one of my friends is coming to town. And we're going to try and put down 5 to 10 places we want to go and try and work something out. I think it would be really fun.
That
I've never
fantastic.
Gone on a trip with somebody who lives across country and we kind of meet there.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it would be a great idea.
So it's going to be a road trip?
Not sure. We're putting down international places as well as places in the U.S.
Oh, that is a great one. I like this travel idea for 2016.
Yeah.
And we've got a caller here. Let's go to Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hello.
Hi. What is your resolution or goal for 2016?
Well, one of my goals that's been on my bucket list for a while is to go to Camp Perry, Ohio, which is a little bit of a trip from Rice Lake, but to shoot in the national matches they have every year at Camp Perry.
In the national matches? Can you just, what is that?
Camp Perry. They shoot pistols and short range. They shoot high power rifles at 200, 300, 600, and 1,000 yards.
Wow.
I won't be shooting that far, but I'll be shooting the 200-yard match, hopefully. So,
is this something that you're able to practice here in Wisconsin, and you think you have a shot, if you'll forgive the word, at winning?
It's mostly just to see if I can do it. It's a lot of fun. The people you meet there and the people you shoot with are you can leave pretty much your $1,000 M1 Garand rifle out in the open, and no one will bother it. People volunteer to help you. It's a really good shooting community, but I do a little bit in the summertime.
All right.
Up in Eau Claire, I do.
Jim, good luck in Ohio this summer.
Appreciate that call, Jim. And time for one more here. Arthur joins us in Green Bay. Arthur, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I am planning on doing a study abroad in Denmark and finishing up my bachelor's degree program.
That's fantastic. So why Denmark? Why did you pick that?
It's the only place in my school that allow me to go.
That's a good reason. It's supposed to be, I think, a fantastic place to visit. In fact, it's on my list, too. It's kind of a long list, and I've got a lot to tick off, but that sounds like a fun thing to do. Are you looking forward to it?
I am looking forward to it. I was hoping for something more Middle Eastern due to my prior deployments to the Middle East, but finally putting that free school to good use. So.
All right, Arthur, thanks a lot. You can keep sharing your 2016 plans, big or small, ambitious or modest, over at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. President Barack Obama announced a series of executive actions to combat gun violence in the United States. In his weekly address last weekend, he said his resolution for 2016 was to move forward with unfinished business, including, in his words, our epidemic of gun violence.
Today, he announced 10 separate provisions. One will expand mandatory background checks on some private sales. Another is going to provide more funding for mental health treatment, FBI staff, and agents for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
Adam Winkler is with us now to go over these executive actions, how they might change gun control and gun politics in the United States. He's a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law and the author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start with President Obama talking today. Here he is laying out what could change, what would change when it comes to background checks under this executive action.
Anybody in the business of selling firearms must get a license and conduct background checks or be subject to criminal prosecutions. It doesn't matter whether you're doing it over the internet or at a gun show. It's not where you do it, but what you do.
So, Adam, some people have on the gun control side have been saying, "Hey, we need to crack down on what they call the gun control or the gun show loophole. We need background checks on all weapons sales." That's not it. That's not what's happening now, is it?
Well, the president doesn't have the authority to just close the so-called gun show loophole. Should specify that there isn't really a loophole for gun shows. It's a loophole that says if you're not a federally licensed dealer, you don't have to conduct a background check when you sell a gun. And you only have to get a license if you're engaged in the business of selling firearms, such as you use it to make your livelihood or whatnot. And so what the president's doing is trying to narrow the loophole a little bit and try to just make it so that some people who are either selling guns and should have basically selling guns and should have a license, that they'll be prosecuted.
So if I have a gun and I sell it to, I don't know, a neighbor or something like that, this would not change anything for me. I wouldn't need a federal license to sell that gun. This would be what? Somebody who sells guns repeatedly over the internet or makes some kind of living selling at gun shows? Those would be the people who might be affected by this?
Exactly. This is not going to affect just an individual who, say, inherits a gun from their parents or a couple of guns or even a gun collection and wants to sell a collection of 50 or 100 guns at one time. What this is the administration said, hey, look, federal law already requires you to have a license if you're engaged in the business of selling firearms. But prosecutors, federal prosecutors, sometimes haven't known exactly what that means to be engaged in the business of selling firearms. Is it someone who sells 2 guns a month, 3 guns a month? Does it even depend on the number of guns that you sell every month? And so what the administration did is it gave guidance to prosecutors to say, hey, you don't have to focus solely on the question of the number of guns a month. You could look at a whole bunch of variables, such as are they selling guns in the original packaging? Are they selling guns right after buying them? Other things that might indicate that they are actually in the business of selling guns and not just sort of the occasional seller like someone you talk about before.
Now, Republicans in particular, gun rights groups, reacted actually to the announcement today, not happy about it. I'm assuming we're likely to see legal challenges, probably both on Second Amendment grounds and on the grounds that this might exceed executive authority, President Obama's authority, and challenging Congress's authority. Do you expect to see that, and soon?
Well, I guess anything that President Obama does gets legal challenges. So I expect that there should be some legal challenges to this. I don't expect they're going to go very far. The story about today was that Obama, one, had a series of pretty minor reforms. And in fact, that clip that you played where he said that every person engaged in the business of selling firearms must do a background check, and he got all that sustained applause, you'd almost think like it was a new initiative. In fact, that's been the law for almost 50 years. So it's been a subject of some debate about exactly who needs to have that license. But the actual substance of what he did was pretty minor. I think the major thrust of it was what it really says about sort of the symbolics of gun control today. We've seen a really renewed and invigorated gun control movement, still no match for the NRA, but still we're seeing a real political mobilization on the gun control side, and that's really highlighted by what seemed to be quite a big to-do about a series of pretty minor reforms.
Well, speaking of the symbolism and the emotion behind it, a lot of people have drawn attention to President Obama tearing up, actually wiping away tears during part of his address today. Here's a clip of around when that was happening.
Our unalienable right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, those rights were stripped from college kids in Blacksburg and Santa Barbara and from high schoolers at Columbine. And from first graders in Newtown. First graders. And from every family who never imagined that their loved one would be taken from our lives by a bullet from a gun.
And in those pauses, you can hear the cameras clicking away, capturing the image of Obama tearing up, wiping away tears. Is this more emotional than we've seen the president get on gun control issues in previous statements?
I think this really highlights how meaningful this issue really has become to the president. You know, when he ran in 2008 and when he ran for re-election in 2012, he didn't talk about gun control at all. He ran away from gun control, talked about the Second Amendment because it was thought to be a real strong loser on Election Day for Democrats. President Obama, as a result, really wasn't interested in gun control until the Newtown shooting. And the Newtown shooting really changed him. And he was passionate right after that shooting about how we need to really do something about gun violence and pushed a big initiative that was pretty high risk because he knew that the prospects for getting serious reform were not great in Congress. But he pushed it, and he's still pushing it. And even for these, like I say, relatively minor reforms, there was quite a big show today in Washington. And I don't say that in a negative way. It's really about how important I think the president really feels this issue is, that it's worth this kind of bully pulpit and emphasis, even if there's only so much he can do.
Talking to Adam Winkler from UCLA, author of the book Gunfight, about the gun control measures, executive actions announced today by President Obama. Want to get into some of the other details of his plan here, Adam. More funding for FBI staff and ATF to try to process gun background checks more quickly.
Well, I think part of the story today, too, is how what these proposals are largely revolved around increasing mental health screening for gun purchases. And as you mentioned, more agents for ATF, more FBI help, and more clear prosecutorial guidance for U.S. attorneys. So it's enforce the laws that we have on the books. Look, the NRA has been talking all this time. What we need to do is do more on mental health, and we need to enforce the laws on the books. And that's precisely what these proposals amount to. They're focused on the exact same issues that the NRA has been talking about for all these years. And beefing up the number of FBI agents to do background checks is important because gun sales have skyrocketed, and there's a lot more background checks to do.
And on the mental health issue, the president careful not to stigmatize people with mental health problems, pointing out that the greatest danger when it comes to mental health and guns is suicide risk, trying to draw attention to that in this address.
It's one of the real sort of hidden things about guns in America, to the extent there's any hidden thing, is that guns are primarily a problem for suicide, not homicide. Now, that's not to say there's not a homicide problem and gang violence and whatnot, but criminal misuse of firearms takes fewer lives every year than firearms do as suicide. And while it's very difficult to keep guns out of the hands of criminals, the NRA is kind of right about that. A determined criminal will get their hands on guns. But a depressed teenager or a depressed person who otherwise doesn't have guns might be actually kept from getting a gun and kept from committing suicide. Not to say they wouldn't try some other means, but we know from studies that guns are the most effective form of suicide by far, and any other means of suicide is likely to lead to actually the person surviving.
Looking at the president's ability to do these things, it's a mixed bag, you say, of fairly small measures. Is President Obama on any of these measures overstepping his authority as president, as his critics say he's doing?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. There's only one. I think none of the things that were announced today pose significant risks of being struck down by the courts. There's one issue that he talked about with regards to Social Security Administration and whether people declared incompetent to manage their affairs for Social Security purposes should be prohibited from accessing guns. But we're not sure exactly what the rule is going to look like, and it's probably not going to be promulgated for a whole nother year. So we'll have to see what that looks like. But that could cause some problems down the line. But again, we need to see what the proposal is.
That's the legal side. Presidential race side, candidates on both sides responding to this. Hillary Clinton saying, yes, and I want to go further. Republicans saying, no, and we'll end all of this the moment we become president.
Well, it really is shaping up that the 2016 election may well be a referendum on gun control. We've had the presidential candidates on both sides really staking out strong positions on guns and gun control, and it's becoming really one of the hot-button issues. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a lot more emphasis on guns in the coming months among these candidates.
We're talking to Adam Winkler of the UCLA School of Law about the executive actions President Obama announced today on gun control.
Yeah, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's plan on gun control? Do you think he went too far or not far enough? And how will these new executive actions affect you? You can call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Adam Winkler from the UCLA School of Law about President Obama's new executive actions on gun control.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the announcement? Too much? You don't like what you're seeing? Or not enough? You want to see more? You want to see Congress take action? What do you think needs to be done to end what President Obama is calling an epidemic of gun violence? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Doug is on the line in Waukesha. Doug, hi.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call. If I'm not mistaken, about 20 years ago, give or take, President Clinton attempted to close this gun show loophole by requiring federal firearm licensees, that is people who hold the federal firearms license to be able to sell firearms, they had to have a storefront. That was supposed to close this gun show loophole because you wouldn't be someone who then just operated out of a catalog. You had to have a physical storefront. That eliminated scores of federal firearm licensees across the country. If I'm not mistaken, it sounds like President Obama is, in essence, reversing that and saying, no, you don't have to have a federal firearms license. You don't have to have a storefront. You just have to have this preponderance of totality that we're going to look at to say you're making your living out of selling firearms. We don't care if you're doing it out of a catalog mm-hmm. or a storefront or however you're doing it.
Doug, thanks a lot for the call. Adam, does his history match up with your understanding of what President Clinton had done?
Well, Well, in the general framework, yes, in the sense that there was an effort by the Clinton administration to reduce the number of federal firearms licensees. There was the thought at the time that if we reduce the number of licensees, we'd have fewer people that we have to investigate, have to check inventory, have to watch over with limited resources for ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And so there was a sense then that we needed to do make it easier for ATF. What's happened since then is the rise of these internet marketplaces that make it very easy for people to become effective gun dealers out of their homes, even without a license, and then they don't have to do a background check. And so part of the idea is responding to new technologies. Now the sense is that what we need to do is prosecute those people who are really engaged in the business of selling firearms but don't have a license.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Bill in Iowa City. Bill, hi.
Hi. You know, I'm curious what's going to constitute a dealer if you sell one gun, two. And the other thing is, why not prosecute the laws we already have that aren't prosecuted instead of making up more laws and putting more burden that we're not going to use anyway?
Bill,
why not prosecute the laws we already have?
Thanks for the call, Bill. So let's start with that second point. Adam, do we have a lot of gun laws out there that aren't being particularly well enforced?
We do have some gun laws out there that are not well enforced, and we need to do more to enforce them. I think part of the thrust of what President Obama proposed today was to focus more priorities on enforcing the gun laws that we have. And so, for instance, the issue with the gun dealers and whether you have to get a license or not, you know, that's existing law, and it's trying to figure out a way to enforce it and enforce it better so that it's actually doing more to accomplish its goals. And so I think you see a lot of that from the administration with these proposals. It is about enforcing the laws we have on the books and not necessarily imposing more burdens on anyone other than someone who's already by law engaged in the business and should have a license.
Bill, thanks for that call. Bill, also wondering, and I don't know if we know all the details here, how are they going to determine who's an occasional seller of guns or passing along guns and who's a gun dealer? Do we know how that border is set now? Adam?
Well, they do have so what the courts, what the administration said was that prosecutors now should follow the lead of the federal courts that have weighed in on this issue in the past. And it's not a question of how many guns a month you sell, which was an old focus of the law, but rather a broader look at a variety of different variables that suggest that someone's really a gun dealer. So if you sell even not necessarily two or three guns a month, but when you sell guns, you're always selling guns that you just bought recently, say the week before. You're selling the guns in their original packaging. You're holding yourself out as a gun dealer with a business card, perhaps, or a website. Those kinds of things can be factored into determining whether someone's engaged in the business of selling firearms. So I think that's what the courts have previously said. What the administration has done is basically created clarification for prosecutors that they can go after those cases, and they don't have to slavishly focus on whether you have a storefront or whether you sell two or three or five guns a month.
Talking to gun policy expert Adam Winkler from UCLA about President Obama's announcement on executive action related to gun control today. Back to our callers now with Kay in Eagle River. Kay, hi.
Hi. Yes, you're asking about, did Obama go far enough? And I honestly don't think he did, because I think there should be something, regulations in terms of the automatic weapons. I mean, I don't know if you spoke about this earlier. I came in and out late, but I think I'm all for having guns, but do people really need to have a cache of, hundreds of automatic weapons and that kind of? I would think that if somebody had to reload, it would take them, they if they're willing, they're looking to take out a bunch of people, it would take out less people.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Adam, as I understand it, fully automatic weapons are regulated, but a lot of people are worried about high-capacity weapons, a lot of ammo, and a high rate of fire.
That's right. None of the issues with the guns today are really about automatic weapons, such as machine guns. We talk about semi-automatics, but that's a very different terminology, and technically it's really no different than a revolver in terms of you want to shoot twice, you got to pull the trigger twice. What's different is about modern-day guns are these high-capacity magazines. They're commonly found in military-style assault rifles, but also found in handguns, and most police officers, frankly, carry high-capacity magazines with them on their as part of their sidearm. So these have become very popular, and they do increase the lethality of firearms. There's not a lot the president can do at this point. He would really need Congress to step in to try to ban high-capacity magazines, and that was one of the proposals that President Obama put forward in the wake of Newtown, but it never went anywhere due to really the NRA's influence in Congress.
Okay, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Rick on the line in Brookfield. Rick, hi.
How you doing? I just have a question that would be retroactive. If these regulations were enacted, would they have prevented, for example, Columbine, Sandy Hook, and the other tragedies? Would they really have been effective?
Well, that's a great question, and I always think that in some ways it's the wrong question in the sense of gun policy should be about lowering the daily death toll from guns, not about figuring out whether a specific incident could have been avoided or not. But at least some of these incidents might have been avoided or might have had at least more roadblocks. So, for instance, we know that the Charleston shooter was supposed to have failed his background check, but when he went through the system, they had 3 days to conduct the background check and do all the information. And they couldn't get all the information they needed in those 3 days. And so he was allowed to get his gun, which he then used to kill a number of people in a church. If one of the things that the president has proposed is having many more FBI agents to conduct background checks so that they have the resources to go through those background checks expeditiously and do a good job on it. We should all be celebrating the idea that we're doing better background checks. Whether you're pro-gun or anti-gun, we all agree that to the extent the law requires you to have a background check, it should be a good and effective one.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rick. And Adam, I wanted to get, we've gotten into the politics and some of the legal issues here. I want to get into the business side of things. We see when there's an announcement like this, or an announcement like this expected, or after a major shooting, there's generally a spike in gun sales. The gun business is doing quite well here in the United States, partly with people anticipating future gun control, isn't it?
Well, I think, you know, President Obama's legacy will be, in part, things like Obamacare and same-sex marriage, but it will also be a story about guns and how he made guns such a big issue, but yet was so frustrated in his efforts to get significant reform. Unfortunately, one of the aspects of that legacy that we'll also talk about is how gun sales have really spiked during the Obama administration. The fear of gun control efforts has really led to skyrocketing purchasing of firearms. Before President Obama was elected, we used to have about 6 million background checks conducted a year, so about 6 million guns sold through federally licensed dealers. Now we're having 20 million guns a year sold through federally licensed dealers. So we've seen a huge skyrocket, the business of guns as well. I understand that some of the stock prices for gun makers were up today, too.
And I don't want to let you go without asking about the states on this. Congress not doing much. President Obama saying he's doing what he can. Are we seeing a lot of action at the state level?
It's all at the state level at this point. Obama's reforms through executive action are pretty minor because there's not much he can do. Nothing's happening in Congress on gun issues or, to be fair, on just about any other issue either. But it doesn't look like the GOP is going to lose the House of Representatives as long as the GOP is in control of the House. Don't really expect any new significant federal legislation to be passed, no matter who's elected in 2016. So as a result, the focus of gun control efforts is going to be on the states.
Adam, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Adam Winkler. He's a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. He joined us to talk about President Obama's announcement today of new executive actions on gun control.